For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. I'm very happy to have with us to speak this morning Michael Mugaku Zimmerman. Michael's one of the teachers, along with his wife, Diane Musho Hamilton, at Two Arrows Zen in Utah. I've had the pleasure of teaching telecourses the last, I think, 4 years at with Two Arrows, and they have students come participating from all around the country and Canada and South America and Europe and anyway, many students. Michael is, in addition to being a good Zen teacher, a practicing attorney and a former member and former Chief Justice of the Utah State Supreme Court. And today he's going to talk about Zen and lawyering. And as we were discussing, one of the translations for Dharma, the teaching that's used sometimes is the law. And so we'll see how those fit together. So thank you very much, Mugaku, for coming here.
Good morning. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I usually give fairly informal talks, so this is a little more formal than I'm used to, but bear with me. Just a little background. I was talking to Taigen earlier. I didn't come to Dharma practice until I was early 50s, and came essentially the way I think I find a lot of people come, at least in our Sangha, looking to relieve suffering. My first wife was diagnosed with terminal melanoma when she was 42 and died a year later. And within a couple of weeks of her diagnosis, it was recommended we go to a workshop on mindfulness meditation that Jon Kabat-Zinn was teaching in Salt Lake City for 3 days. We went to that. The idea was it might be of assistance to my wife. And to me, too. She was, I think, getting depressed at the time, and I don't think she was very interested, but I found it fascinating. And shortly before she died, I started sitting just by myself in the mornings on the front porch because nothing else was working. Having a drink at night wasn't working. Upping my exercise regimen wasn't working. Taking on more work wasn't working. And just sitting in the early morning before the girls got up and meditating gave me a little spaciousness, which otherwise I felt like I was locked in a little box 3x3 with no way out. I had we had daughters, 11, 7, and 4 at the time. And I had just taken on the job of Chief Justice, so it basically, I didn't quite know what I was going to be doing, how I was going to manage all of this, and sitting in the mornings managed to give me a little equipoise. And I found that that was something I could carry with me during the day and began to kind of resort to mindful sort of meditative awareness when things got really tough. And a couple of years later, I met a woman who's Musho now, who had studied Tibetan Buddhism and had a meditation practice, and she told me there was a Zen center near my house where I could go learn to meditate. So I just went down and took to it like a fish to water. I came to it basically from a relief of suffering perspective. But as a lawyer, and I'm kind of academically oriented, I started immediately reading and trying to harmonize it with not just finding it as a way for relief from stress and suffering, but how did this fit in with what I was doing? You know, if you think of the Eightfold Path, how does lawyering fit in as a profession? It's not selling drugs or guns, but some people would see it as sometimes not much different. It's a dispute resolution mechanism, and it beats fists and knives. So that's essentially, you know, humans are always in struggle, and so law is a formal mechanism for allocating power and for keeping order. And it's, you know, you start studying the precepts, and the precepts sometimes sound like the Ten Commandments, but of course they're, I think I always see them as sort of guidelines, if you will. But how do the precepts fit in? You know, how do the precepts fit in with our meditative practice? And how does that, you know, how does that relate to law? How does that relate to how we live our lives day to day, and our and meditation and mindfulness and the opening to uncertainty, which is essentially the heart of Zen practice, because law and precepts are very rule-oriented and very injunctive, and mindfulness practice, meditative practice, Zen practice, emptiness, is essentially disequilibrium in the sense of it undermines all of your certainties. And that's seems to me opening to uncertainty and losing certainty are two different things. So I encountered a passage in a book by Hee-Jin Kim, which is a fellow who wrote a book called Dogen Mystical Realist, and then he wrote another book on meditation and thinking, Reflections on Dogen Zen. And it's a little fascicle within, it's a little piece within a fascicle about dream within a dream, which as I understand it, and Teigen would know probably better than I, but is the idea that everything is a dream constructed within the uncertainty of our inability to actually know. And the fascicle, this fascicle talks about a steelyard. Now, a steelyard is essentially a beam scale. And those of you who are old enough remember going to a doctor's office when you would step on the scale and there's a long beam and you move a weight on it, and it takes only a small amount of weight here to counterbalance a great amount of weight on the scale pad. And that's a traditional scale that you will find in all cultures over time. You go to museums, you'll find beam scales. They're portable, they're easy to use, they can weigh large amounts of weight. So Dogen, in this piece of the Shobo Genzo, says study a steel yard in equilibrium. When we study it, our power to discern minute differences in weight manifests itself without fail, and thus puts forth the expounding of a dream within a dream. Unless we consider weight differences and thereby attain the equilibrium of the steelyard, no fairness is accomplished. Only when equilibrium is attained do we see fairness. Once we've obtained equilibrium, it does not hinge upon the object to be weighed, the steelyard, or its workings. In emptiness, the steelyard embodies equilibrium. Fairness is the great principle of the steelyard. By virtue of this principle of fairness, we weigh emptiness and things. Whether it be emptiness or form, we weigh it to meet fairness. That's the way I understand it is that the author suggests that Dogen is using this metaphor to point to the teaching that the emptiness is equilibrium. In other words, the whole universe is in equilibrium. It is constantly being enacted because it's always changing. And of course, it consists of all of the dharmas, all the phenomena that constitute it. And we as actors, because we cannot but be actors, whether we act or don't act, we're actors. We are part of the whole phenomenology, which is the universe. But we have choices. So we have to make decisions whether to act or not. And as beings who are becoming aware of this emptiness, this equilibrium which constitutes emptiness, have an obligation as beings with volition to weigh everything we can to the best of our ability. We are the scale. We are the steelyard. And to resolve to bring things into balance in the next moment. So essentially to enact fairness. But obviously, we can't be attached to the outcome. Because if we're attached, then our egos have stepped in. And we will be unable in the next moment to weigh fairly. In other words, our capacity as the steelyard becomes better and better over time. Our capacity to weigh improves as our insight develops and as our ability to transcend our desires and aversions develop. So to continue to refine your capacity to weigh means you need to be less and less attached to the outcome of your action so that in the next moment you can fulfill your primary function, which is to weigh and then resolve to act. Does that make sense? So essentially the arc of action is I form an intention, I act, and then my ego's natural inclination is to attach to the outcome and to either reject it because it's somebody else's fault that it didn't eventuate, or attach to it because I made it happen. So can I continually learn to evaluate everything around me to discern what needs to be brought into balance and act in whatever way I am capable and is most likely to produce fairness, to produce equilibrium, to produce balance in the whole universe? And obviously things are very close to you, you have some capacity, and things that are very far away, you have no capacity. things in the long future, you have minimal capacity. Things in the near future, you have great capacity. And Heejin Kim suggests that this is part of the emphasis in Dogen on practice. And practice, not just meditative practice, not just developing contemplative mind, but actually acting in the world. That too, and the way I view it is to simply sit and attempt to have insight into emptiness and insight into essentially distance from your own desires and aversions is only halfway. And that no matter how much you are able to become at remove from your emotional life and from the ways it pulls you around by the nose, it's a solipsistic venture if you don't take the next step and act in light of everything and everyone rather than in light of yourself. And I take it to be a strong, you know, it's a strong injunction. And as a lawyer, you know, as any actor in private or public, I think it's a nice lead into the scales of justice, because that's ideally what Lady Justice is doing. She's weighing all phenomena blind. And not giving herself any primacy. And that's the other part, of course, of the Steelyard, is as the Steelyard, you can't give yourself primacy. You don't come first. Your interests are not the primary interest. You are measuring and then act, but then stepping back and acting, because of course you're both emptiness and you're an embodied, alive, mortal creature. And perfection is never going to be attained, but perfection is static. There's no such thing as dynamic perfection. Dynamic perfection is the scale. It's the constant movement of the scale, and it's the constant enactment or effort to enact equanimity. So I think it's a very powerful metaphor. In fact, my wife calls her Sangha the Dragonheart Sangha because she's kind of fierce. And she said, mine's the Steelyard because it's always, you know, I'm always trying to bring things into balance. But Dogen says, Kim suggests that Dogen is saying that emptiness cares about differences in the world, in worldly truth. Emptiness cares about difference. The absolute cares, the absolute, I don't like the word absolute, but emptiness, all the dynamic flux of the universe cares about balance. And we are an intelligent manifestation of the universe. And to fulfill that natural role and the insight that you're gaining from your practice necessarily requires and naturally should produce an urge for fairness. Um, I think it's bracing. It's a clear vision of what we should do as practitioners. And I think it makes sense. The precepts then aren't any different. If you think of the precepts, you can think of the precepts as range finders, if you will. You know, a precept, the precepts are benchmarks or points that you can refer to in your life that indicate your sort of where you should be generally. But as the steelyard metaphor suggests, there's a huge open field in which the precepts are staked out. And in the open field, things are never the paradigms that the precepts talk about, because it's far too dense, it's far too complex. They're just indicia of how one would behave if one encountered that pure circumstance. But your life day-to-day is infinitely more complex than that. And so they, you could use them to check your targeting, I suppose. But a better way to think, I think, of the precepts is that if, in fact, you come from this realization that you are simply, you are a manifestation of a universe which is seeking balance moment to moment and is always going to be going out of balance moment to moment, your job is just to bring it into balance. Well, if you see your interconnection with other sentient beings, if that's your constant reference point, the precepts become secondary. Secondary in the sense that you will respond much more subtly than even the precepts suggest. You'll be much more alert. I mean, Dogen uses the term mutan to characterize his insight into the capacity for self-deception and self-centeredness of human beings. Mutan, I understand, translates as human bottomless elusiveness. In other words, we are so elusive to ourselves. Our self-centeredness is so elusive that we can never possibly find it. So if you just throw that into the balance, that's one more thing to be weighing when you're deciding what to do. And you could say, well, then this makes it so complex I can't do anything. But of course, you don't have that choice, do you? Because in the next moment you have to do something or not do something. And not doing something is something, right? Because karmically it has effects. Everything has effects. So it's a huge ethical obligation. It's a very uncertain enterprise. And this practice calls you to do it and to become better at it and better at it and better at it. And a side benefit is the more congruent you are with the universe, the less angst-ridden you'll be, the less sense of existential dysfunction you'll have. Psychologically, you'll be more integrated. We go to the neuroscience, you know. You'll be a more integrated being, and the world around you will function better. And other people will be pleased. So it's hard to see the downsides, except that it takes a lot of work, and it takes accepting the responsibility for making mistakes all the time. But you'll make the mistakes anyway. And if you don't accept the responsibility, then you're right back in the delusion that you started with, that somebody else is supposed to make life better for you, get rid of the things you don't like, give you the things you want, which I don't think anybody on the face of it is going to suggest is reality. I'm quite fond of the steelyard metaphor, because I think action, you know, the fundamental question, aside from our subjective, no, shouldn't say it that way. The one thing we can control to a large degree is our subjective intention. And if our subjective intention takes account of everything as best we can, it's bound to produce psychological, a sense of psychological well-being, because we will be settled. We as complete beings will be settled in our relation with the external world. So that's why I like the steelyard metaphor. And I think no matter what you do, whether you're a lawyer or whether you're some more benevolent form of life, my experience of my law practice since I've been practicing Zen is I have found it much more enjoyable than I did before. I find it far less stressful. I recognize the choices I get to make are often determined by what my clients' positions are. But that's the situation I find myself in, and that's where I have the ability to bring more balance into the situation in the next moment, to bring less personal distress, to try to make my clients see reality and make decisions based on reality rather than their preferences. And I find, I'm involved in litigation all the time, and I don't find it in the least bit ethically distressing to do that, to recognize the scope of what's possible for me to do in the context in which I'm working, in a way that I come at it with as positive an intention as I can have for all those that are concerned. And at the same time, the capacity to do that from a skill set standpoint means that I'm more able to take the perspective of all the players, take a meta perspective on all those perspectives, and then pick what's the most useful for my client within the ethical limits of the practice that I'm doing. So it's actually skill enhancing at the same time. I mean, the better a steelyard you are, it means you're enhancing your your capacity to take multiple perspectives and then take perspectives on your perspectives in a way that makes your actions more skillful and less likely to be damaging. So I found the practice to be utterly consistent with everything in your life. But particularly I like the metaphor because of the law and because I've always been concerned with power and how do you use it skillfully. And power is a fundamental part of being alive, and its exercise is inevitable. So how do you do that? And everybody here has power, sometimes, and sometimes you're powerless, but where do you have power? What are the dimensions of your power? How does it seduce you? How does it facilitate? How does it enhance you? How does it enhance your capacity to perform? Those are all things that the steelyard is also weighing. So there's nothing that doesn't go on the scale. And there's nothing that you do that isn't clarified by thinking of it in terms of ascertaining circumstances, balancing them, and finding the intention. So I'm happy to answer questions, talk, comments, thoughts.
Thank you so much. I'm sure people have a lot of comments and questions. I just want to say, I think that's a brilliant talk, and just the idea of the inherent balance of emptiness as a metaphor for justice, wonderful. And my question is, if you can think of an example, maybe you, I don't know if this is something that you can say, but when you as a judge use this way of thinking in some particular case, if that's something you could give us an example.
Well, okay, I can talk about... There's a case that used to trouble me a lot, still troubles me, doesn't trouble me as much. But thinking this way kind of helped me get a sense of why it troubled me. So this was a death penalty case, and it was there were four African American enlisted men in their late teens, early 20s in Utah back in the early 70s. Who resolved to rob a hi-fi shop. And they went in and they took hostages, and everybody walked in the store, they made a hostage. And they had seen some movie, whether it was a Dirty Harry movie or something, where somebody had fed Drano to somebody to kill him. And so they resolved they were going to kill the hostages by feeding them Drano. The bottom line is the whole thing ended up with about four people dead. One person survived, but was had to drink Drano, had a ballpoint pen punched in his ear, was shot, was disabled. A woman had been raped and was killed. And so it was pretty horrible crime. And one of the guys got a reduced sentence because he snitched on the other two. The two who were in the basement where the killing was done. And then the two who were in the basement, two of the ones in the basement, one of them never had killed anybody and never administered any of the Drano, but was there and was assisting. And the other guy was the one who did most of the stuff. So during the trial, there was evidence of racial bias. People left notes on the jurors, lunch table, hang the niggers kind of thing. So there was evidence of racial bias. At the same time, the crime was horrific. The two principal people in the basement were sentenced to death. The primary actor was executed. The other one appealed. He would have been the first person in the history of the state who had not actually committed a murder to be put to death for murder. There was, as I say, evidence of racial bias. When I went on the Supreme Court, there were six people on death row. Five of them were black in a state that had 0.5% African-American population. And when you see these death cases, you get a strong sense that whether you get death or life depends entirely on whether the jury can identify with you. And pretty clearly, the jurors weren't identifying with African-Americans. And this was not tried in Salt Lake City. It was tried in a smaller town. So this fellow Andrews had appealed, and his appeal had been confirmed over and over again, and his trial had been looked at and decided that there were no harmful errors. And my situation was, this was relatively early when I had come on the court, and the appeal came up for one more post-conviction review, and essentially there were really not any grounds left that were available under the rules. You have to understand that on appeals, basically, the whole system is set up so that once some issue is dealt with in the trial court for the first time, the presumptions are very heavily in favor of it being correct. And the more times issues are vetted and then affirmed on appeal, the less room there is to go revisit anything. And if you think about it, just as nothing can be done perfectly, the legal system, we would simply try cases forever, over and over and over again, if every error resulted in a retrial. And that's the way the system works, and that's just the nature of it. In some ways, it's a relatively crude system, but it's one we've agreed to, and it's one that we support, and it's simply a dispute mechanism that works. So by the time this case had come up to us this last time, he was to be executed within a month. He had changed from the time he was committed. The crime had been committed. It was 17 or 18 years. By the time it came up to us, he was in his late 30s. He had become quite religious. He had become a worker in the prison clinic. He had, by all objective measures, become an exemplary human being. And yet, on paper, there were almost no grounds for giving him a stay. And so I kind of agonized over this, and I wasn't the swing vote. There were two of us that were sort of dissenting, but eventually I voted to affirm the guy's conviction, and he was executed shortly afterwards. There were police cars, you know, in front of our houses because there was a big up, you know, there was a strong anti-death penalty sentiment, and because of the fact situation, he was clearly a person that, as of today, the day he was executed, you would not have adjudicated him worthy of execution. And the case always troubled me whenever I thought about it, and I couldn't figure out why. This is a long way around the barn, but what I finally came to is my job as a judge was, the way the legal system works, was to appraise the correctness of his conviction as of the time it occurred, in light of all the other institutional reviews that had been done. And I was not empowered to weigh whether he should be executed as he was on the day he died. My job was to weigh whether the person who committed the crime had been given appropriate consideration, and giving that person who showed up on the day the murders were committed in the hi-fi shop was properly sentenced to death. That person is a different person than the person who died. I felt a strong personal, I mean, I used to get tearful about it when I thought about it, that this man should not have died. And I should not have. I would love to have been had some way not to do that. But I was in a position to weigh in on it because I had taken an oath to support the Constitution and the legal system, and I had no authority to act but for that oath. So to have done anything else would have been inappropriate. So what that gave me was sort of multiple perspectives on my capacity, and also an understanding that the one who was feeling badly about it was one who was seeing it from outside the role that I was playing.
It's an interesting example. Yeah. Thank you.
It's not an example where I can say I got to do something heroic in the long term. I mean, I could pick some of those, but this is harder because it requires you to actually sort through what can you legitimately do in this moment. You know, a better example, let's take, you know, an easy example. Somebody walks in here with an AK-47, right, and is about to machine gun the whole place, and I have a pistol, and I have a choice. I can kill them, or I can let them kill you. So I kill them. And I widow somebody, and I orphan some kids. And there are karmic consequences all over the place. And there are other karmic consequences, of which a certain number of people aren't killed.
You don't have rules about not bringing consequences.
This is Chicago.
I don't know if you have that kind of rule in Zendo and Utah, but
we can. The law lets us, but otherwise, yeah.
We didn't put the sticker on.
Yeah.
We're not in Kentucky. We're going to
have a problem. Well, thank you. I appreciate your being willing to share that. I want to let other people, you know, the whole idea of emptiness and the balance. So we have extra time. We're not going to do formal temple cleaning today to allow more time to have people discuss with Michael. So, Jason, please.
Yeah, this is a question that was coming to me during your talk, but I think it the last question and answer maybe makes it a little sharper. It has to do with this. I'd like to bring it in terms of your being a justice, having been a justice, but I think it has an applicability to all of our decision-making. You were emphasizing decision-making quite strongly in your talk. And, you know, when you think about, I mean, excuse me if I say something really ignorant here because I'm not a lawyer or anything like that, but you emphasized the constraints you were under in making the decision you made then. And in general, acting in that kind of capacity, it seems as though you have obligations to, you know, written law, to precedent, to the way things are normally done, to the way your role is constituted, mm-hmm. how people think of you, what they expect of you. On the other hand, you talked about this sort of infinite complexity that we always operate under. And one of the sort of features of Zen practice particularly is that it, at least potentially, helps you see around the edges of all those constraints, to see other possibilities, and to make your decisions less on the basis of you know, all that's previously been determined, and perhaps more on the basis of what you at least perceive as some kind of, you know, gut insight kind of thing. And those things, particularly in that world, seem at least potentially very strongly in conflict. But I would think for all of us, you know, we all I mean, do you have any comment on that? I mean, as a regular citizen, the things that I need, the external things, so to speak, that I need to adhere to in my decision making are less defined, less strong, or whatever, but no less real. And there can sometimes be a conflict there. And I'm just sort of wondering, somebody, I mean, you, in that position, you're living out two very different approaches, and I just sort of wonder if you could comment a little bit.
Well, I think, you know, this goes to the nature of power to some degree. I mean, the things about being a judge, the limitations are what you do to some degree establishes, if in fact you are honest about it, give license or limitation to those who come after you. So to the degree that you expand the scope of the legitimate exercise of discretion, you create problems, possibly, for the future. To the degree, easiest example, right? Trump tweets, get rid of the filibuster rule, right? Because he would like to see 51 votes be enough for everything. Not that it would have helped him, but okay, why don't you do that? Well, the reason that the Republicans aren't doing it completely, the Democrats did this back when they had power, the Republicans do it, is that they know that they'll be out of power and they want to have a say. And if they abolish that now, it'll come bite them later. So the more power you have, particularly institutional power, the more you should be constrained, because it's foreseeable that the discretion you want to have personally, the personal power you want to have to exercise prerogative, is one you have to give to others. And the concern one might have about the current circus atmosphere in the way the president's functioning is that for 20 years, is this politics? Or will the system rebound? That, just think of that from an institutional standpoint. We can say that the president right now is behaving like he lives in a reality TV show. The problem is, so is the whole culture moved to that place. So while it may have advantaged those who now are in power to have created that, it potentially disadvantages them and all of us because we've now loosened the standards. That's the nature of culture. That's the nature of institutions. And to some degree, that's the nature, you know, if you occupy positions of power like that, you're constrained by them if you actually are trying to be at all farsighted. And to some degree, I would say that the capacity I have found, the capacity to get things done in ways, make changes that may be positive, sometimes are best done not when you have the formal structural power, but when you're using other means. In other words, administrative discretion, or when you're using things that don't institutionalize, because there's a tremendous amount of, we get to exercise a tremendous amount of discretion in our lives where we're not constricted by position. You know, things you do as a parent are to some degree just like that. You know, parenting is the same kind of thing. Every institution is the same. It constrains you unless you're willing to recognize that if you're not constrained, neither is anybody else. So I think that situation that I described, there's certainly plenty of situations where I managed to do things that I thought should be done within the limits of what had been done. And that's always the problem with institutional power. Yeah.
There's a lot here, but I'm going to try to rest maybe consensus here. The thing with Celiar, the thing with, you know, being on the waiting station of the doctor's office, that I am balancing something. The balance is still referencing something. There's still a standard or a metric. And what I find difficult sometimes when thinking about like a Buddhist ethic or a Buddhist law, for lack of a better phrasing, is that it still seems to be referencing, at least in my everyday common personal private citizen kind of way, referencing some kind of rule governing behavior. You say, right something, right thing, way of approaching appropriateness. If you really see into the emptiness, if you really sat it with that emptiness and internalized it, what you do will be appropriate. But at the same time, I feel like when one really sinks into the practice, the ethics is not something fully, there are no static rules by which our behavior is governed. It's something that is really intersectional, or really, it's not just situational, it's intersectional. It's broad. I feel like it's a much broader view that's needed. But then also has reference to the fact that, these rules that do exist right now in an everyday sense are only here impermanently. Yeah, as much as we would like them, some of them could be permanent in our personal lives. But at that point, I don't know if there is any metric by which to measure something like an intersectional impermanent ethics, which is what Buddhism seems to orient itself to.
Well, I think that's what Dogen's addressed. You know, that mutan, that term, you know, our bottomless capacity to fool ourselves in in a universe where if you look at the neuroscience, we live in essentially a simulation chamber. So we're living in a simulation, dream within a dream. I mean, we really don't know, and we have the obligation to act. So it really makes first the issue of balance, first the issue of appraisal, first the issue of analysis. And I think, unlike, like the D.T. Suzuki view, I suppose, of enlightenment, which is, we just disappear into the ether kind of thing, this is saying, okay, you've been to the ether, now come back, and there's a really, really hard, complex human question before me with huge impact for person A, and maybe it's positive, and then negative impact for persons B, C, and D, but how substantial is it, and then what's the precedential effect, and what's going to happen a week from next Thursday? You still have to make the decision. And it, if benchmarks help, don't kill helps, don't steal helps, great, but you're probably not thinking about killing and stealing. You're probably thinking about something, really, really subtle. And this is where your practice, this is what I almost say, your moral obligation is to become more enlightened, more awakened. Because nothing else is going to make the decision. Your obligation is to be emotionally aware of what's going on around you, to subtly watch the way people are co-creating each other in the moment to moment. To hold that space as an observer and then make the choice, recognizing you may regret it.
I think in spiritual communities we can really do a lot to try to avoid thinking about them, and especially saying them. I gave a talk maybe a couple months ago on what I call the arsenal of compassion, by which I meant that sometimes to act out of compassion we need to do things that are fierce. And I continue to feel uncomfortable about the topic and having given the talk, and yet I think it's so true that we need to do just what you're saying, which is continually examine ourselves, but we do have to act. And there are situations where people can take, sometimes spirituality makes us want to just be nice, and people will just take our niceness and see it as weakness, or not respected or not listened, and they're. These are really profound truths. It's uncomfortable to listen to your example, but I appreciate it. I mean, I'm sure it was unbearably uncomfortable to live through the example. But we are in Chicago in particular. We live in constant gun violence and. As well as police brutality, and I have friends who are police officers, it's like I kind of live with both sides of this, but I appreciate your coming here and just giving and sharing this talk with us.
Yeah, and it, it's just always hard. I mean, the other side is, I remember a murder case, where a guy wanted to be killed, the defendant did. He had, was a returned Mormon missionary, and he had kidnapped and murdered four or five young boys, you know, sexually abused them, and then confessed and refused to be defended. And, you know, we had to review the case because we had automatic death penalty review. And some of the kids he had, you know, killed were about the age of my kids. And, you know, their parents would take them to the grocery store and they'd go around the corner and he would entice them away. So they'd just a grandparent, you know, out with a child and turns around and the child's gone kind of thing. And you read, then you read the guy's confession and then you have to say, did he get a fair trial? And I couldn't even think about deciding for 3 or 4 weeks because I could identify completely with these people. See, but that's kind of, but that's just examples of stuff that we do all the time. And I think you're right. In spiritual, a lot of us come to spiritual communities for relief. Existential relief, personal relief of some kind. And this is that's what we want here. And that's, I don't think there's anything illegitimate about it. I think that's, relief comes in different packages. And ultimately relief is actually having to engage who you are, engage your desires and your aversions, to watch the person you are moment to moment. The times when you're cruel, the times when you're unpleasant, when you're self-absorbed, when you're desirous, and recognize that's what it is to be a human being, and nothing you're ever going to do is going to end that. And the question is, can I see that in myself compassionately and see it in others compassionately?
And also engage the world.
And engage everybody at the same time and recognize that we also, to the degree that you manifest as the steelyard, you do the steelyard business and you manifest positively, you create a response in the world. You create, just think of it the smallest possible way. I very firmly experience that if I'm a jerk, I will create a jerk in the other person. If I am not a jerk, the other person who's a jerk will change in some degree in the next 5 minutes while I'm present to them. And I can't know the consequences of that change. We all have that capacity every moment of our lives, and we don't exercise it. We just indulge ourselves most of the time. That's just a little thing. But hell, if you can create a little positivity, you don't know what that's going to do.
Thank you so much. I wanted to, we should wind up fairly
sure.
soon, but Douglas has, I don't know, maybe others, but as another attorney in the room, I wonder if you have any comments from that perspective, special advice.
Don't seem fair that I would have told the commercial lawyer example would be somebody rents a tour boat down on the Chicago River, needs a new engine for their boat, represents the vendor, and so the engine doesn't work, and he's now not going to be in business for the next month, but our contract will always say, we will always say, as the vendor, I'm not responsible for the money I'm going to earn because I gave you something that doesn't work. That will always be the case. And I will be sued if I am negotiating this contract for the vendor and I don't build that clause into it. And the buyer's attorney will expect it to be there and will not really contest it. You can nibble around the edges, but that clause is always going to be there. Yeah, I think everyone would say that just seems wrong somehow, that I can do something that causes so much damage to someone and not be responsible for the damage that I've done. And you can make arguments about, well, that's reflected in the price, which is not really true. I mean, nobody is really taking that into account in pricing. And, you know, what would I say? Okay, what would be the negotiation for you to step up to?
Yeah.
To making them whole for the consequences of your having sold a lousy boat engine. But, you know, I think those are what happens when you work within human institutions. I think Buddhism has not, has been different historically from Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, where justice and social justice have been bedrock concepts of those religions for thousands of years. And Buddhism hasn't talked about it that much. And so the basis for what is a Buddhist social ethic can be tough with other European ideas where the Bodhisattva idea that, you know, it's not just trying to wake people up and everybody can make the Buddhists, you know, read the Lotus Sutra and or the Uttamasaka Sutra, and people on the way are supposed to be doing good for people in practical ways. And even if it's something that's sort of high flown and sometimes seems very abstract and bizarre, it's the Uttamasaka Sutra, as people learn to do practical things, you know, feed people, build bridges, develop even spiritual powers to help other people. But there's not the same conceptual framework. I think that's, for better or for worse, it's a challenge.
And just to add to that, part of what I find intriguing brought up from Dogen is that it does seem to be talking about justice, that this this metaphor of the steelyard balance is talking about some fundamental sense of justice inherent in the balance of emptiness. So working with this question that Douglas just brought up about social justice in Buddhism, and this seems to me to be maybe a grasping straw, but some fundamental sense of justice and emptiness. So thank you for bringing that in.
Well,
but I think that the idea of justice and what the balance is and what's fair is changes over time. And you decide what's going to be balanced against what. So for much of our history, you kill somebody, you will be killed. It's a life for life, you're going to balance it. And over time, people have said, I mean, there's clearly that's still part of the law. But other people have said, well, no, I mean, that doesn't make sense. But, you know, at least here, it's the death penalty will be a preventive. If you're going to make an example of someone, prevent more murders. Killing somebody is a bad thing, but if you kill this murderer, you might prevent other murders down the road, so the balance is, you know, going to protect more people. Then, like, what happens when you, if finally you have social science and research that suggests that that's not true, that will not happen, you've still got laws that say, they commit the murder, you get in front of the
forced to lie.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're essentially... Yeah, lawyers are essentially plumbers. You know, I mean, there's rules of plumbing. You know, there's certain water pressure has to go here. You have to have certain couplings and, you know, the rules and regulations about how big the pipe has. I mean, they're mechanics in a way. And like you say about your example on the warranty, the place to go to change that is the legislature, or it's some judge who feels he or she has a measure of discretion that most wouldn't and says, no, that's a bad clause. But, you know, it's the legislature's got to change that, and ultimately the market. I mean, that's what you mean about institutions. We all struggle with institutions, but I do think what Tygen's saying about Dogen, or at least that metaphor in Dogen, you know, that could easily talk about social justice. It could talk about labor justice. It could talk about, you know, all the traditional things. And I have to think that the reason Buddhism has gone the way it's gone is largely because of the cultures within which it's not the teaching, it's the cultures within which it arose.